I have a dream.
One small step.
How many we say?
The wall must go.
Diner, Princess of Wales.
Right into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
On the 16th of December, 1907, a fleet of ships painted white sailed from the harbour of Hampton Roads, Virginia, and set out on a journey around the world. It was to last for 15 months and it would wow the locals wherever it stopped. The fleet was made up of 16 US Navy battleships, and because of the white paint, it became known to history as the Great White Fleet. Its job was to project American naval power in every port, and in Australia it was met with a rapturous welcome. It's even said the visit played a key role in Australia establishing its own navy. John Perryman is the Director of Strategic and Historical Studies at the Sea Power Centre, which is the Australian Navy's history unit, and he joins us for This Week in History to look back at the Great White Fleet. Hello, John.
Hello, Sarah, and that was a great introduction to what is in fact a really, really interesting part of naval history.
Well, I'd never heard of it before, so let's put it in context. You say that this is a story as much about Theodore Roosevelt, the American president, who was in the twilight of his career, as it is about the fleet itself. So let's put it in context and take us back to America in the 1880s and the pressing need that it felt to really beef up its naval power. What was going on?
Well, Sarah, in 1880, the Naval Committee of the House of Representatives had a really good look at the state of the United States Navy, and it issued a very, very bluntly worded report, which was authored by Representative Benjamin Harris of Massachusetts. And it spelt out in no uncertain terms the parlous condition of the ageing US Navy. And in that report, Harris argued that the US Navy comprised mainly dilapidated wooden sailing ships dating from before the Civil War, as well as only a handful of small riverine craft. Now, in a rapidly advancing technological world, when sail was giving way to steam, and at a time when other major powers were investing really, really seriously in upgrading their navies, it was obvious that the US was fast being left behind. So, did that report have an effect? Absolutely. It was sharply worded and it did attract attention. And it reminded those in the US that just 15 years previously, at the end of the American Civil War, the US Navy was staffed by men trained and tested in battle. And the same at that time couldn't be said for any of the other major powers. So in a very, very short space of time, that navy had run down, and they certainly weren't competing with the other navies of the world. And, of course, you know, there's reasons for that decline. Arguably, the reason for the decline of any armed force was that at that time there was no foreseeable threat. And when that happens, the money is normally directed elsewhere. Mm. And in America's case, most of it was going into developing the industrial and agricultural potential of that country.
Right. And so when Roosevelt came to the presidency in 1901, he in particular believed that naval power was crucial. Was he expecting conflict?
Look, I'm really glad you raised that point. Roosevelt is central to this. From a very early age, a young Teddy Roosevelt had demonstrated an unusually keen interest in naval affairs. At 24... after leaving Harvard, he established himself as a credible naval historian. He published a book called The Naval War of 1812, and this sort of precipitated his entry into politics. But in that study, he really established himself as someone who not only could speak from an historical perspective about naval matters, but he really clearly demonstrated that he had a grasp of sea power. And in that, it led him to the same conclusion as Benjamin Harris, and he didn't hold back. In fact, he actually wrote that it is folly for the great English-speaking republic to rely for defence upon a navy composed partly of antiquated hulks and partly of new, rather more worthless than the old. So his summation of the state of the US Navy was that it really, had got to the point where it was in need of a complete overhaul. Now, to answer your question directly, by the time he came to the presidency, he'd held that view for almost 20 years. And during that time, he'd established some really, really useful and important relationships with prominent naval strategists, chiefly Rear Admiral Stephen Luce and, more importantly, Captain Alfred Thayer Mahan. Now, both of these men, and in particular Mahan, they had worldwide influence on the understanding of sea power and the influence that navies had on shaping world affairs. And people around the world were sitting up and taking notice of what those men had to say. So his relationship with them really was important. You had these two naval strategists. You had someone who understood sea power and the history of sea power, who was also a politician and a navalist.
Right. He was the special person, obviously, who was in the right place at the right time for America. But was it also about protecting the possessions it had won in the Spanish-American War at the end of the of 1898? What possessions did they have that they were worried about getting nicked?
Look, you're absolutely right. I mean, the possessions that they won in that war against Spain gave them Guam, it gave them Puerto Rico, and it gave them Cuba. And they were very, very important strategic assets. And their involvement in that war was as much to do with their economy as well as sympathy for the Cuban people, who they saw as being repressed under the Spanish regime. So, yes, it was about that. It was about consolidating their place in the world as a world power. The Great White Fleet and the American battleships and the rejuvenation of its fleet took place in America. It was going to use American technology, American design, and American steel. So they set about that. That, of course, was set against the backdrop of what was going on geopolitically.
Right. And Roosevelt, so they were already worried about Japan at this time.
Look, they were. And, Roosevelt was keenly aware of the geopolitical situation, particularly in Asia. And indeed, Mahan took it upon himself to keep Roosevelt informed on this very issue, and in particular with Japan, which, it had already triumphed over China in the Sino-Japanese War of 1894-95, and it was further expanding its navy. Now, Japan, it was having battleships built for it in the United Kingdom. So there was little doubt that Japan was emerging as the preeminent power in Asia and that it was building a large navy.
Okay. So they had 16 battleships built, and the plans were secret for a while until very late in the peace. What was the reaction like in the US when the plans to tour this Great White Fleet were announced?
Right. Well, look, initially it was more about repositioning the Atlantic fleet into the Pacific. And that was really done to counter the concerns about Japan. Now, that was precipitated in 1906 with an incident that took place in California, where Asians, and in particular Japanese students, were prevented from attending normal schools. It was said a bill was passed that they would go to a special school. Now, this really upset the Japanese because there had been an agreement in place and this breached that. So Japanese pride was at stake and this situation took hold quite rapidly, and it really ticked off Roosevelt. He felt that the Californians pushing this agenda potentially could actually drag America into a war with Japan, and he wasn't keen on that at all. So he repositioned, as tensions rose, he repositioned the Atlantic fleet around into the Pacific but held it on the west coast. So initially, this was a tactic that he used. Roosevelt was a very charismatic, strong man, and he did not want the Japanese to perceive him or his actions as being weak. So he felt that it was very, very important to take an affirmative action, but he didn't want to provoke Japan unnecessarily. So the moving of the Atlantic fleet around into the Pacific as an initial step was seen as being sufficient to send out a fairly clear warning.
Right. Sorry. So is this the Great White Fleet that they moved there, or that's other ships?
No, this
I'm
is
a bit
the
confused.
Great. This
right.
is the.
Okay.
This is in fact
but
the Great White.
But it was a whole world tour they were going to do, not just the Atlantic.
Well, look, that sort of came
later
afterwards.
On.
But
right.
The initial, if you imagine the chessboard is set, So the initial play is that the fleet is repositioned from the Atlantic around South America through the Straits of Magellan into the Pacific and held there, and then He's privately had plans to do this. He keeps his cards fairly close to his chest. But then he determines that, no, I will send these ships around the world and we will make a very, very powerful statement.
Right. You're on Nightlife. We're listening to John Perryman, who's a naval historian, talking about the Great White Fleet, because it was on the 16th of December 1907 that this fleet sailed from the harbour of Hampton Roads, Virginia, to journey around the world for 15 months. So why paint them white? Was this about saying these are ships of peace as well as a show of force?
Look, in those times, it was normal peacetime configuration for warships to be painted white. It certainly drew attention to the fleet. And you can imagine the fleet sitting there, 16 warships, resplendent, gloss white paint, lots of filigree, lots of bright work. They would have looked both resplendent and menacing at the same time. Mm. Now, white, of course, is certainly not the best colour for a warship, particularly those that were coal burners, and these were in those days, because coaling was a routine activity, and it was one that sailors hated because normally it was backbreaking work followed by cleaning up. So it wasn't until much later that the grey paint schemes were adopted around the world.
They must have done a lot of washing on board then, right?
Absolutely, and you can imagine the mess that it would have left.
Yeah, all right. So where did it stop?
Well, the voyage began on the east coast of the United States. It made its way south, calling at numerous ports in South America, and they received a rapturous welcome there. It then steamed through the Straits of Magellan into the Pacific, calling at more ports on the western side of the Americas. And from there, it steamed west, visiting Hawaii, New Zealand, before coming to Sydney. Mm-hmm. And it arrived there in August 1908.
Right. So before we get to Sydney, what are some of the interesting things that happened along the way? There was a big biffo in Brazil.
Look, yes, and by all accounts, that was an epic battle. This took place when a bit of a fracas broke out in a bar between some of the local seamen and sailors of the United States Navy, and it was found that the incident wasn't actually instigated by the sailors of the Great White Fleet, but it was a real Donnybrook. And at the end of it, apologies were issued by both parties, and the schedule went on uninterrupted. So it was a bit of a storm in a teacup. But for those involved, yes, it was a good blue, as we'd say in Australia.
I'm sure. But, I mean, the other thing is that they're representing America. They didn't want to get into blues. There were rumours that anarchists were planning to blow up the fleet. Were they based on fact? And what kind of impact did that have?
Look, there was indeed concerns for the security of the fleet and that it might be subjected to acts of sabotage. I mean, what precipitated the war with Spain was the US had sent one of its warships, the USS Maine, into Cuba. Not to stir things up, but simply as a guarantee that, you know, if riots continued in Cuba against the Spanish, that the American people there, the citizens and the consulate could be protected. But the USS Maine hadn't been there long when it blew up. And there was some conjecture about what caused that. It's still really not known to this day, but at the time it was widely held that it was the Spanish. So they'd lost an American warship in recent times, and security was very much an issue. As I said earlier, they were coal-burning ships, and there was one incident where they took on coal from a Norwegian ship, and amongst the coal there was half a stick of unexploded dynamite. Wow. So that caused concerns, but you know, it was found that that probably had more to do with the mining process involved with getting the coal in the first place than any deliberate act of sabotage.
All right. Let's get to when the Great White Fleet arrived in Australia. This was in August 1908. It was a massive turnout.
It was an absolutely tremendous turnout. 250,000 people turned out in Sydney. And when you take into consideration that, you know, a population of 600,000, it gives one a sense of just how big event that was. Yeah. And, you know, try and imagine this, Sarah. Most people are familiar with Port Jackson, Sydney.
Sydney Harbour, yeah.
Yep. So these ships steam into Sydney, 16 battleships. Now, if they're 500 yards apart, they're going to take up 4 miles of ocean.
Oh.
4 miles. So nothing like this had ever been seen in Australia before. Yes, the British had a squadron there, but we were very much the antipodes, and realistically, many thought that the Royal Navy was paying lip service to naval matters in Australia. And we'll talk about that a little later on. But when you imagine that at those times, these 16 modern battleships steam into Sydney in line ahead and then proceed to their respective anchorages in that harbour, it would have filled that harbour. And what a sight it would have been.
What a spectacle, yeah. So did how many sailors got off and had a good time in Sydney?
Well, all of them were giving shore leave, or liberty as the United States prefer to call it. And the atmosphere, to put it mildly, was festive. Parties were the order of the day, and there was this all-pervading carnival spirit. I've only ever experienced something like that a couple of times in my own naval career. Once was during the 1986 75th anniversary naval review, which took place in Sydney Harbour. Again, the harbour was full of ships on that occasion, and then we reprised that in 1988 for the bicentennial naval salute. So my sort of, if I put myself in that picture, I think it would have been, you know, one of the best parties to have been at.
Right. Well, I don't know if you got 250,000 people turning out, did you?
No, I don't think so, but there were certainly a lot of Sydney-siders there and well-wishers and,
lots of partying.
Yeah.
And the citizens of Sydney presented the fleet with a kangaroo. Did they take that on the trip?
Look, I'm familiar with the photo of the kangaroo with the US sailor, but I really don't know what happened to it. It most probably remained on board because spread throughout the fleet was a total of 70 animals, most of which were mascots.
Oh.
And that number included, you ready for this?
Yeah.
25 goats, 32 dogs, 12 parrots and a donkey.
Oh, my gosh.
And I imagine there would have been ship's cats thrown in the mix as well. So there was quite a bit of cargo.
Yeah, there sure were. And then they went to Melbourne. Was there a similar reception for the Great White Fleet in Melbourne?
Yes, there was. You know, the carnival atmosphere continued in Melbourne. And as one author wrote, it severely tested the endurance of the American sailors. And the National Maritime Museum in Sydney has a very, very good display of the visit of the Great White Fleet with some of the ephemera and postcards and souvenirs that were produced at the time. It really, really was a big event.
It's a terrific museum. You're on Nightlife. We're hearing from John Perryman, naval historian, about the Great White Fleet. So had a great time in Melbourne as well. And this did influence Australia, did it, in terms of building up our own navy? Were we inspired?
Undoubtedly. You know, at the time the Great White Fleet visited Australia, we were in pretty well the same situation that had been recognised by the Americans in 1880. We had the Commonwealth Naval Forces, which was basically an interregnum between the colonial navies of the colonies and the formation of the Royal Australian Navy. So when Australia is federated, those colonies that had navies, principally Queensland, New South Wales, South Australia and Victoria, those ships became the Commonwealth Naval Forces. But those ships were, you know, many of them 40 years old by that time, and they really weren't fit for purpose.
Right.
So Prime Minister Alfred Deakin saw this as his opportunity to arouse interest in the Navy within Australia and garner support for creating our own Navy. And, of course, that followed 5 years later in October 1913. The Royal Australian Navy Fleet Unit steamed into Port Jackson, just as the Great White Fleet had 5 years previously, and we had a navy of our own.
Mm-hmm.
Quite fortuitous, given that we were at war less than 12 months later.
Exactly. All right, we can thank Roosevelt for that, perhaps. So what about Japan? How did it go down?
Well, surprisingly, with all of the tensions of the preceding years, it really proved a very, very successful visit. The Japanese provided one of the warmest welcomes of the entire voyage when the fleet arrived in Yokohama in October 1908. Now, tens of thousands of Japanese schoolchildren have been taught to sing American songs to greet the fleet. And this was very, very well received by those in the fleet. And, of course, it was watched very, very closely diplomatically. So I think that that part of the voyage, it was a very, very successful diplomatic circuit breaker that restored US and Japanese relations.
Oh, fantastic. So it was serving a purpose of that white peace after all, perhaps, in some way. So when did they get back to America and how were they received when they got home?
Well, look, the fleet arrived home at Chesapeake Bay on the 22nd of February 1909, where once again there was a tumultuous turnout to welcome at home, comprising of visitors from all over America. The weather wasn't great, but it certainly didn't dampen their enthusiasm. And, of course, Theodore Roosevelt, he was there to welcome them back. And he took it upon himself to go on board the flagship, the USS Connecticut, congratulate Admiral Sperry and the ship's officers and crew. He saw that navigation, or circumnavigation of the world, as a huge success. He addressed the men of the Connecticut, and he actually ventured and said that, you know, other nations may do as you've done, but they'll have to follow you. So he was well aware that he'd pulled off a world first. And remember, this fleet, Sarah, there was 12,793 officers and men in it. The ship's gun batteries totaled 360 guns, ranging in size from 6-inch to 13-inch. And if they were to fire a single salvo, it would have cost $50,000 of money in those days, which is about maybe $1.2 million in today's money. So for that fleet to have deployed for 14 months and steamed over 42,000 miles without a major breakdown, in spite of known design deficiencies, he knew that he'd pulled off a pretty good feat.
What do you think the voyage of the Great White Fleet achieved for America?
Undeniably, it announced America's arrival on the world stage, Sarah, as a serious world power that could project power. And the way in which Theodore Roosevelt did that was unprecedented in the modern era. It was the first movement of great battleships, and it was designated to test his Navy's professionalism, arouse popular interest and enthusiasm, and as well as achieve his political and diplomatic aims. And all of those aims were achieved. The popularity of the Navy in the United States soared, and that enabled successive US governments to continue the shipbuilding program.
Right, led to so much about America's peak, which I think is possibly in a little bit in decline now, but that's a story for another day. It's an incredible story, and I just wonder what happened to that kangaroo.
Well, I do too. Let's hope it made it and didn't hop over the side.
Yeah, there must be so much fantastic history for you to look at in this. I thank you so much for talking to us about it tonight, John.
Thank you very much for having me, Sarah.
John Perryman, Director of the Strategic and Historical Studies at the Sea Power Centre, the Australian Navy's History Unit on the Great White Fleet.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.